From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode, number 111. Remember the Wild Foods $100 giveaway? Well, we have a winner. Congratulations to Desiree from Texas. I hope you enjoy your goodies. I spoke to Desiree earlier today and she has just recently started keto, so this will be a lovely treat to keep her on the keto track. Well done, Desiree, and thank you to everyone who took part. I'm thrilled to welcome back Carolina Cartier to the podcast. Carolina was one of my first extraordinary women, and you can listen to her story by going all the way back to episode number 5. Diagnosed with PCOS at the age of 13, Carolina struggled with weight gain and infertility for 16 years before finding keto. After significant weight loss and reversal of her PCOS diagnosis, Carolina embarked on a career change from financial analyst to certified nutritionist, and will be graduating with a Master's in Nutrition from Basta University in June 2020. Her research thesis title is Perception and Awareness of Carbohydrate-Controlled Diets for the Management of PCOS, a benchmark study. It examines the experience of women who have modified their diets in an effort to normalize their cycles, combined with the experiences of clinicians and their perception of carbohydrate-controlled diets. Now 5 years keto, Carolina loves sharing the life-changing power of dietary change with others and hopes to continue her research in a PhD program. Carolina and I chatted on for ages, so I have split the recording into 2 episodes. Here is the first part. Welcome, Carolina, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back.
We were just discussing before we started recording, trying to figure out how long ago it was when we first recorded, and we reckon it's about 2 years. You were one of my first extraordinary women, weren't you?
Yes, and I was still pregnant at the time, and
just barely. You were just on the edge of giving birth, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. And now the boys are about to turn two next week. So it's been about 2 years.
It has. How exciting. Why don't you catch us up a bit on what you, well, it's pretty obvious what you've been up to in the meantime. Young boys are a whole lot of work, but just refresh the listeners' memories for those who haven't listened to the first one.
Yes. So at the time of the first podcast, I was pregnant with twins and I had used keto to help increase my fertility and then was surprised when I ended up being pregnant with twins. That was completely unexpected. And I maintained keto through my pregnancy, which is now much more common, but it's still something that's being researched. And we have that question of what is the right thing to eat during pregnancy, which is, it blows my mind that we don't have a set diet for pregnancy. But I ended up being discussed on Diet Doctor as well, my story and a lot of other women who have done that. So the boys were born 2 years ago. It was in November. I had been accepted into a university for a master's in nutrition and ended up deferring a year due to the pregnancy. So we had the boys. That was a shock. It was wonderful and lovely. But to anyone who's been a new mom or a new parent at all, it is a completely different experience than anything you've ever experienced before. And then when the boys were about 9 months is when I started the master's program. And so I am now just over a year into that program, and I will be graduating in about two quarters, June 2020. And it has been an amazing experience to really focus on the research that I want to do, which is about fertility and specifically ovulatory fertility. What allows that to be optimal? What interferes with regular ovulation, regular fertility in menses? So I've been working on that in a research thesis, because when you're getting a master's in nutrition, for the most part, there's two tracks. You can go to the dietetic track and become a registered dietitian, or you can just get the master's, become a certified nutritionist. And at my school, you write a research thesis as part of that master's program, which is what I've been doing for the last year.
Exciting and full on, I imagine. I mean, looking after
it is a
twin
lot.
Boys is full on.
I won't
Let's
lie.
Just add a research project to that.
I have been quite overwhelmed at times. That is true. And I'm human and there are normal challenges. So some things I just don't get to. And it's every day is a prioritization of what's next. But it's been wonderful in a way to have this chance to really focus on what I want to focus on as far as research goes. And there's such a big gap when it comes to just optimal fertility without any interventions. So we're looking at just nutritional therapies or what someone's eating every day even, and what that does for fertility. It's, again, surprising that we don't have more research. We don't have a fertility diet or anything for that, which theoretically might be the same as just what's the optimal diet for the human to eat might be what's optimal for fertility. Although we do see in history, a lot of cultures when preparing for pregnancy would add in extra things to make sure that fertility was optimal. So just having a chance to focus on that and hopefully fill this gap. And then, you know, we spoke earlier that I'm looking at PhD programs, and there are programs and labs working on human intervention trials to say, okay, what can we do? But what I'm really seeing is that they're predominantly focused on, when it's diet related, just calorie reduction, calorie restriction. And they say, okay, the point is just to induce weight loss. But I think there's more to that story. As we spoke about in the first episode, PCOS, which is the primary cause of ovulatory irregularities, although there are other causes there, that seems to be driven by insulin resistance as one of the primary pathophysiologies. And it's multifaceted. There can be other pieces, but that really seems to be a driving factor. And when you reduce someone's overall calories, you tend to reduce their carbohydrate as well. Like, you know, if someone's eating 250 grams carbohydrate in a 2000 calorie meal and then you reduce them down to 1500, you usually reduce carbohydrate and fat and protein. Mm. And so that is, you know, what I refer to as just a carbohydrate controlled diet. It's on the spectrum of reduced carbohydrate from baseline. And so an issue that I see with all these interventions only looking at caloric restriction is they're not necessarily examining what effects the individual reductions in macronutrients might have. They're just looking at calories. And there's plenty of research out there that that may not be the only driving factor when we look at weight loss and other things.
So you've mentioned your research, and I know you're looking for more candidates to help you with that. So why don't we dive into exactly what you're doing, all those juicy details. Just before Carolina tells you all about her research, I just need to take a few moments to tell you about this week's podcast sponsor, Superfat. Superfat make a certified keto and paleo line of macadamia and almond-based convenient on-the-go closable nut butter pouches. It's a tough choice, but I think my favorite might just be the protein flavor, which has almonds, macadamias, sunflower protein powder, cinnamon, Himalayan pink salt, erythritol, and stevia in it. I have to admit, I was a little bit worried when I read that some of the packs contain stevia, because my taste buds are super sensitive to it, and I find it way too sweet to the point of being nasty and bitter. But they have got the amount just right, because I can't even tell it's there. There is just the right amount of sweetness to make the ones that are sweetened, because not all of them are, ridiculously delicious. It is such a close call, though, that I would always still opt for the variety pack, because I want to have them all. Why not try them out for yourself or treat a friend to the perfect keto Christmas gift? Use code DAISY for a festive 15% off your order at superfat.com. Thank you for taking the time to listen, and thank you, Superfat, for supporting this podcast. Let's get back to Carolina and find out about her research.
Yes, thank you. I am a master's student, and so this would be somewhat of a small-scale research thesis that I'm doing. It's based on surveys at this time. And what I'm hoping to do is to take the information from these surveys into a PhD program where we can actually test this in an intervention style study, right? And so what I'm gathering, there's three pieces, but there's really two that potentially your listeners could help me with. The big survey that I'm doing is called my implementation survey, and it's looking for women who implemented any sort of carbohydrate control. So if you're on the low carb spectrum, or if you, you know, implemented caloric restriction and as part of that your carbs went down, and if you tracked any of this information, carnivore, keto, any level of what you call your diet. So looking at women who have implemented that and any changes that happened with their ovulatory regularity as far as they know it. And that may just be maybe their menstruation changed. Maybe it was absent or irregular, which is related to how often you are ovulating. Essentially, I'm examining carbohydrate reduction or control and its effects on fertility and ovulatory regularity. So if any women have been through this and they have, you know, they've tried it, and whether it was successful, quote unquote, or not, you don't necessarily have to have had pregnancy as a goal. Having a regular cycle is part of a healthy body. And so even if you were like, I just want to resolve this issue, because the symptoms of irregular menses go beyond just menstruation and ovulation. And so a lot of women are just trying to heal their bodies and to feel better. And so whether pregnancy was the goal or not, I have a survey for you that you can fill out. I say it takes about 15 minutes and it asks questions about what did you eat when you were on a carb-controlled diet? Did anything change with your menstrual cycle or your ovulation? Did any diagnoses change, such as PCOS, if you had that? Or any other comorbidities that you might have been diagnosed with, like thyroid issues or things like that. A big one I have on there is, you know, how did you hear about low carb? Was it from a medical professional? If not, did a medical professional support you? Something I see often is, you know, women following low carb without the support of their doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, it is what it is. And I want a world where we can be honest with our physicians and say, hey, if I feel better on this, can you support me or not? So learning that information, because as we move forward and we're looking at therapies, if this is something people are going to do with or without the support of their physician, maybe we need to make sure the physician is prepared. So that is the long explanation of the first survey. That's the implementation survey. I have the link up on my social media. So you can go to Keto Babies on Instagram or on Facebook, and I have the link there. I can give it to you for the podcast as well.
We'll have it all in the show notes as well.
Okay. Yeah. So that is the public survey. I ask you to share it far and wide. I have something around 150 responses right now, which is decent for me. You know, I'm just someone in a master's program, but I would love to get a couple hundred more if possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is there. I have another survey that is just for clinicians. And so the plan is to take the implementation survey and then take the clinician survey and see what kind of disconnect we have or similarities or what we can do. Again, if we're looking at a nutritional therapy type plan to be tested. So for the clinicians, I keep that link private just because I need to send that directly to the clinician so that I have some control over who's responding. So we're talking, you know, MDs, registered dietitians, nutritionists, nurse practitioners, midwives, anyone who is certified in some sort of medical profession. And this is their perception and awareness of carbohydrate controlled diets for the treatment of ovulatory irregularity. The reason I'm looking at this one is, again, we already see carbohydrate control being used, and I know you and I see it leading to positive outcomes. Mm-hmm. And yet the stance officially when it comes to nutritional therapies is that it is not recommended. It may or may not have any influence. If it did, it would only be from weight loss is generally the standard response. However, I'm trying to gather information actually from clinicians saying, okay, do you see this used in your practice? Do you support it or not? Do you recommend anything else? Do those work? Do you think there's enough research or gaps in research? So things like that. Now, that survey for clinicians is only 20 questions. It should only take 5 to 10 minutes. So if you think that someone in your life who's a clinician would be interested in using that, if there's a fertility clinic you go to or, you know, a women's clinic or anywhere that you think the clinicians would be receptive, feel free to contact me again through the Keto Baby social media. I am happy to share and forward that link to a practice or to individual practitioners because I do want to gather their perception. And if it's founded, right, you know, perhaps their perception is that it doesn't work and you can't lose weight on a low carb diet. Well, then we can look at what the research says and possibly disseminate that information a little bit better, whatever the perception is. Or if they think, oh, it's going to harm fertility, then perhaps that needs to be tested. So the combination of the two pieces of research hopefully will give us a reason to move forward and a mechanism of saying, okay, we have these endpoints that we want to look for, and this is how we're going to test it.
Because ultimately, the goal here is just to help people achieve the goals they're trying to achieve. It's not about trying to make trouble. It's not about trying to push out some kind of new fad that you're trying to sell. Your goal here is just to help people get what they want to get.
Yes, thank you.
And that's what just seems so sad, doesn't it? That there is often this pushback and this opposition to eating this way that we've seen that helps so many people. You know, you're a perfect example of that. And yet the official stance is the opposite, is that potentially it could be harmful, or no, this is what you're supposed to be doing, which tends to be very high carb, not only for pregnancy, but then you see it for breastfeeding and on and on and on. And it's really just trying to cut through that, isn't it? I think it's great that you're doing it from both directions and trying to get to everyone involved and trying to find some kind of middle ground that ultimately helps people.
Yes. And, you know, it would almost be easier if I were selling a pill, right? Mm. I mean, we have no issue getting metformin prescriptions or birth control prescriptions, which are, those two pills are the standard protocol right now. If there's ovulatory irregularity, it's like, here are two pills you can take. Best of luck. Lose weight. Mm. And that is the end of our treatment plan if you go to a doctor, unfortunately, for usually PCOS, that's the standard protocol. My only goal here is to help prevent, honestly, the suffering that women go through and their partners or just anyone from the diagnosis. In my case, I desperately wanted to have children and was told that wasn't going to be an option, and that was very painful. And I had PCOS for 16 years with no treatment of any kind. They said, take metformin. I did for a while, but the side effects are quite unpleasant. And it didn't really help me. And it wasn't until I decided to try low carb and said, let's do this. There seems to be something there. Thankfully, one naturopathic doctor tested my insulin levels, and that's what spurred me, you know, going into the realm of keto. And from there, it was pretty much smooth sailing, right? There were bumps in the roads, but all of a sudden, my symptoms disappeared quite quickly. And this is, you know, something that's important that I have learned in my research is that we talk about weight related to fertility. And in PCOS, they'll say lose weight, right? Be normal weight. You don't want to be overweight. You don't want to be underweight. And that may be true for most people, but weight is not a criteria for PCOS. And there are normal weight, quote unquote, women with PCOS. There are even underweight cases of PCOS where it's the lack of body fat alone may be causing lack of menses, but they still have the other symptoms of PCOS, the other diagnostic criteria. And so there are, you know, four phenotypes that we currently have of PCOS, and weight is not a factor at all. So while in some phenotypes, it's more common to be overweight, that alone isn't the issue. And so that's where I have some problems with the research focusing solely on weight loss. And in my case, and in the case of many others out there, I started keto and I was morbidly obese. And 4 months later, I started ovulating. I had lost weight, but I was still morbidly obese, right? I didn't suddenly become thin and perfect and all my problems went away. My symptoms went away while I was still overweight. And I see that all the time. So I think it's a disservice to focus only on weight instead of the other underlying mechanisms. I think of extra weight as a symptom of underlying problems. And so when we start addressing those underlying problems, the weight starts to go down, but we'll see, you know, symptom reduction kind of outpacing weight loss almost. And I think that we need to examine what that is. And that's the hope of this research.
Yes, because presumably if you're focusing solely on weight loss, quite possibly because that's what you've been told to do, and you go about it in quote unquote the wrong way for helping those other symptoms, you're not going to see that outpacing that you saw.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's just going to lead to more and more frustration, isn't it?
It is. And I had tried, you know, I'm like many of us, I don't remember the exact number, but it says that by the time they're 18, most women have tried at least 3 or 4 different diets, right? And I did that. I was diagnosed with PCOS when I was 13 years old. And so going up to age 20, I tried all sorts of things to lose weight, including taking high dose metformin that is supposed to help, which it did not. And it was mostly focused on caloric restriction. And I tried, and you know, I won't go into the whole debate about caloric restriction, but my version that I tried was pretty high carb caloric restriction because it's all about the rice cakes. And you know, it's all right. It's all about the brown rice and the rice cakes and, you know, your potato with no butter. And so looking back almost 20 years now, you know, my version of what I was trying to do with the only guidance I was given from my physician, which was next to nothing, really wasn't working for me. And then I would become so grumpy and so hungry that I couldn't maintain it for very long. I wouldn't see any results. And I would just go right back to eating more because I was hungry, legitimately hungry, because it wasn't working. And I was, you know, starving myself, but still having all of the issues of a high glycemic diet. So we shall see. What I have learned through the course of writing a research thesis in the course of this and working with the IRB, for anyone who's ever had to get approval, that's a long process. But taking bias out of research is a skill that you have to learn.
Oh, I bet. Very difficult to do, I imagine. Removing your own bias, because I mean, it's just inherent, isn't it?
Well, and we hear this all the time. You know, I go to a lot of low carb and just health conferences. And we hear all the time when research is being criticized and we say, oh, well, this person has this bias. So let's just say plant-based, for example, right? You will see a lot of plant-based individuals performing plant-based research. And lo and behold, they'll say that their results match, that this is, you know, better for whatever they were testing. Well, here I am, someone who's had amazing benefits with low carb, and I'm testing the effects of low carb. And so I understand that a bit more. I understand the motivation. And it isn't necessarily that we have these, you know, nefarious plans of what we're going to do, although there may be some people who don't have the best of intentions. But I understand how difficult that is, because we're saying, look, I've had these amazing results with XYZ. I want to see that in other people. And so what I had to do was really step back when I was writing these questions, especially take the bias out. What level of carbohydrate did you aim for? And that's it. Not, you know, did you eat below 20? Yes or no? Instead of that, because this is the level that I have decided is right. Mm. So taking that out. And 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I noticed I had a very different attitude when it came to, like you said, the right way to keto or the right way to low carb. And I've learned that is much more open to interpretation. And we're looking at endpoints, we're looking at goals, and you can get to those goals a lot of different ways. And so remembering that my goal is to help women and couples have a healthy fertility, having a greater chance of conceiving if that's their goal, and all the side effects that come with not having normal fertility, if we can eliminate those, that would be great. There are a lot of comorbidities associated with PCOS. The rate of type 2 diabetes and heart disease are very high in the PCOS community, and you can reverse that, right? Of people with type 2 diabetes, a lot of them have PCOS or other fertility issues. We know that, for example, insulin has direct inhibition of some of our phases of folliculogenesis, so creating follicles, being able to ovulate. Insulin directly affects GnRH, which comes out of the pituitary, and it increases our LH secretion, which suppresses our sex hormone binding globulin. And so this is just an example, right? It gets really complicated. Sex hormone binding globulin, what it does is basically binds to free testosterone and takes it out of circulation. And so if someone who we want to have lower testosterone doesn't have the binding globulin to take testosterone out of circulation, then they have higher levels of testosterone. And so we can see that. And so insulin has this, you know, it's five steps removed, but it's there. It's all these multifaceted pieces. We do see higher levels of LH in people with PCOS. And then we also see higher levels of testosterone most often, although there is a phenotype where that isn't the case. There's just a lot of pieces. And to narrow it down to you're overweight is just too simplistic. And we've done that for how many chronic diseases? You're overweight, that's the problem. Instead of saying, wow, it looks like there are a lot of issues at play here that may be contributing to your overweight, and we can address all of these individually.
Yeah, like you say, looking at it just as one of many symptoms, what you're always trying to do is get back to that core issue and tackle that. And if you can tackle that, mm-hmm. then everything is going to start falling into place, including the weight, rather than just zoning in on that. Mm-hmm. It always seems to be the case, doesn't it?
It's always the case.
It's about your weight.
And I understand, because especially the Western world, right? We see often that chronic illness is occurring in people who are overweight. So it's easy to visually see that and get so focused on that piece.
And it's a good visual marker of change, isn't mm-hmm. it? You can see the difference quickly. Mm-hmm. So you can just assume from that everything else is going the same way.
And we have that. We have visual bias on a lot of different things about someone's appearance. And that is, in a way, human. It's another learned skill to take that out, to take that bias out of your mindset about anything about someone's appearance and what you think may be or not be causing an illness. And again, we see PCOS in normal weight and underweight women. So it is not the only cause, if a cause at all. I think it's more of a symptom. And there are amazing people doing work, physicians and researchers, around what is the optimal human diet as a species. Is there one? Is there a spectrum? Is it dependent upon what you can tolerate based upon your personal environmental factors or bacteria? And I'm not even going into that realm. I'm looking more at, for what we already know from a hormonal perspective and the downstream effects of carbohydrate, specifically glucose, what does that do, positive or negative, to different parts of the cycle? Something I've just recently learned and I'm now putting into my literature review is that IGF-1, which is mostly discussed, you'll hear it thrown around cancer, right? Is it good? Is it bad? How much do we need? When? Where? IGF-1 is used in the first phase of our cycle to help create follicles, follicular genesis.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and it makes sense. In pregnancy, IGF-1 is increased because we're growing. It is a growth factor. Mm. And there are times where we need increased levels. Like most hormones, they ebb and flow and they pulse, and there's different levels for different things. And this idea that everything needs to be as low as possible or as high as possible and just set there just doesn't seem to be the case. And there are even treatment protocols for IGF-1 deficiency. Like, I didn't even know this existed until a few weeks ago. So now I'm starting to look into this, because too low of IGF-1, which some people are trying to do, they're trying to suppress it, can actually lead to ovulatory problems, such as just not creating follicles, that so therefore you can't ovulate. We're learning more all the time. And here's just another hormone in the mix. It is not simple. And I think 2 years ago, I wanted to say that, you know, it is pretty simple. It's just high insulin causes most of the problems. And while I still think that's a definite contributor and maybe one of the underlying pathophysiologies, there's more to it and there's more nuance. And I think that if low carb is useful for increasing fertility, I have to say if, in my case, it seemed to work, but if it is, we don't know all the mechanisms. I start geeking out. I get so excited. I hope this PhD happens for me and for everyone else, because like, there is a gap. And sometimes I go to look for information and it just isn't there. I'm searching the entire research database and there's no information, no research study about what I want to know. And I've looked at some pretty large meta-analyses where they examined all these different things, omega-3s and the effect of dairy and the effect of soy and the effect of all these different things. And basically, they all came out to no effect. We don't really know. The only thing that we can definitively say seems to be not beneficial is trans fats. But there wasn't anything that was particularly beneficial when they looked at individual dietary components. And so, what's the answer? I don't know. Hopefully we can find out, or at least start to unpack that a little bit, because the rate of ovulatory disorder is increasing, right? We haven't really had a dip. It continues to be a problem, even in non-overweight people. It's becoming a problem. It's just a lot of money that's going into IVF. And sadly, IVF is not always successful. And so that's just a very emotional upheaval to go through that process. It's financially draining, it's emotionally draining, and then to not conceive in the end, that's a lot to go through. It's hard. That's only if you even have the means to afford IVF. And for those who don't have those means, they're kind of left with lose weight and cross your fingers, right? Hopefully it'll work.
I was listening to a podcast the other day, and what you were saying about what's happening generally with fertility, and they were saying that there are problems with male fertility as well, that mm-hmm. that's also going down by, I forget the percentage they were saying every year, but was also a problem. It's definitely something that needs addressing. And if it can be something as simple, and I mean, I know it's not always as simple as being as simple as diet, but I mean, for us, it does seem so obvious, and it is something that everyone can access. Like you just mentioned about IVF, that's a very particular group of people who have the funds, or, you know, depending whereabouts in the world you are. You know, I know in the UK, some people have access to it on the NHS. They might get one go at it, more than one, depending where they live, depending on different criteria, or it's going to come down to finances. But there are going to be a whole raft of people who just simply can't access something like that. And the potential of being able to get some of the similar benefits just by changing their diet, it's, you know, it's exciting, isn't it? I think it's very interesting what you were saying about nuance and how different processes, you can't just label something as being bad or good. when you were talking about the different processes there, I was thinking of inflammation. That's something that's always bandied around, isn't it? Inflammation is bad, you know, that you're going to get inflamed by doing that. But of course, the basics of it, it has a very important purpose, doesn't it? It's just sort of when it gets out of control.
Right. Acute inflammation, it's part of our injury response.
Yeah.
And you want that. Absolutely. If you have a cut on your hand, you want inflammation. You want, you know, white blood cells heading to the area. You want to get out any bacteria that's been introduced. And that mechanism is in there for a reason. The mechanisms of insulin are there for a reason. It's more about, are we overstimulating or understimulating, or is there some apparent process, is it genetic or whatnot, that seems to be going not quite right for whatever reason. And it's about figuring out if we can manipulate that, or at least bring that back to baseline. Perhaps, you know, we're manipulating it by what we're eating. Perhaps it's something else. It seems to be multifaceted, definitely. And, you know, on the piece for male factor fertility, anyone listening may have heard of Clomid. Now, it's typically used to help ovulation occur. And the reason is that it increases LH hormone, which then can help you create follicles and then ovulate. Well, in men, you can take it as well. And it's being used to enhance fertility and overall just testosterone levels in men because it's the same mechanism. It increases luteinizing hormone, which then increases testosterone as well. But the concern with some of these interventions is that we know in men, if you increase testosterone too much, whether you're injecting it directly, you're increasing LH, you're using anabolic steroids, something along these lines, too much testosterone can be converted to estrogen. And that's actually the primary way that men create estrogen, which is necessary for bone health, right? But if you have too much, then you get too much estrogen. And if your goal is a certain amount of hormone balance, once you start interfering with hormones, it gets messy. It's a very delicate
really messy,
dance. Yeah, it's very delicate. And the physicians utilizing these therapies have to monitor you very closely, whether we're looking at IVF, whether we're using Clomid, whether it's direct injections for men or for women. Testosterone levels, whatever the level is, are very important in everyone when it comes to fertility. It's different balances for different people at different phases of life. But yes, once we start directly manipulating, it's messy. And our bodies are brilliant at having what they should have for whatever they're trying to achieve on their own. And, you know, I somewhat theorize that whenever this is out of balance, that's more our interference disrupting the balance more so than them getting out of balance on their own. And so it's kind of returning to baseline. I say that because our biology and physiology is around procreation. And so I would say that whatever the levels are, you know, eating whatever the optimal diet and the optimal environment, that's what the levels probably should be. But it's hard to say what is the optimal level of IGF-1. We don't really know. We can say, well, these people have this level and these people have this level and these people seem to be healthy, so maybe it's that level, but we don't really know.
What strikes me about a dietary intervention, and I know, you know, we have our own bias here, but what it seems to me for all sorts of things, it just came to my mind when you were talking about this, just returning to baseline. And that's what it seems to be to me with low carb and keto. It gets people as close as possible back to their optimal baseline, which puts them in a much better position to then start with potential treatments. Mm-hmm. Getting as close as possible to that and then start manipulating things if you have to. You might find that you don't need to. You might find that that's all you need to get you to where you need to be. Mm-hmm. But when you're so out of whack because of what you eat and because of the lifestyle you have, and then you start with these messy interventions, you can see how things just keep spiraling the wrong way, and how it's going to be such an advantage to get you back as close as possible to that baseline and then start manipulating things.
Well, and I think about that with metformin as the primary treatment currently for PCOS. We know that it can directly cause B12 deficiency by inhibiting absorption of B12. I have asked just in general on Facebook groups when people say they were prescribed this, and they're talking about their diet and they say, you know, I'm trying to eat lower protein and I'm on metformin. And I'm asking, did your doctor mention at all that you should have a B12 supplement? Did they mention getting B12 in your diet? I'm just curious if they said anything. And it's always been no, no mention of that. And I'm thinking, all right, well, B12 deficiency can cause massive problems, including early miscarriage.
Wow.
So if you're using metformin as your primary treatment for PCOS, and you may not even know that you were pregnant or not, by early miscarriage, spontaneous miscarriage, it might have been within the first week. So you may have what you think is a normal period, but it could have been a miscarriage. And we don't find that out unless there were an ultrasound, or perhaps you had one positive pregnancy test, but then we see nothing there on ultrasound. So that's a potential side effect. And so I'm not saying there's no use for metformin, but it gets messy, right? We have to look at a lot of downstream effects.
And anything, I think, when you take one form of medication, that then means you have to take another one to deal with the problems that the first one's caused. And then you have to take a third one to deal with the problems that the second one's caused. And before you know it, you're taking a handful of pills every day.
Yes, exactly.
So basically, the more people you can get, the more participants you can get for this research project, the more likely you'll be able to take that next step, the PhD step.
Yes. If I'm able to have an intervention study with this information, then yes, it would be much more impactful in the medical community saying, you know, we've done an intervention. It may be a randomized controlled trial or something in that spectrum where we're actually providing a controlled meal, and then you have better results. And what I'm trying to do is build that basis to warrant further research by saying, all right, here are three different bands, for example, that seem to be successful in restoring fertility related to carbohydrate levels. And I also asked about protein levels and whatnot. So, for example, if that's what the results are, then I can say we have a reason to investigate this in a controlled environment. A lot depends on if I get accepted to a program, the lab I get accepted to, the funding that we have. You know, you end up working with your research advisor on their projects for the most part. Like, you can have your own to a degree, but they're overseeing you. So I am hoping that I get more responses, as you said, to really flesh out what are we eating already? That's what I'm trying to examine. Not can I just come up with any number. I could put people on a 10 gram per day carbohydrate meal, but for what reason? Why? You know, I'm just kind of making that up. But if I see, wow, there's a lot of success around 20 grams, 50 grams, 100 grams, or maybe they say 200. I said, you know, what was your goal and what is your definition of carbohydrate control? One of my big goals, if I get to do this research, is to actually have a definition in the literature of what is low carb, what is a carbohydrate controlled diet, and anything around that. And what I found in my literature review is that in the studies that say they're testing a low carb diet, often those diets are maybe 40% carbohydrate.
Mm.
And that's because the RDAs in the US say that your carbohydrate should be 45 to 65% of your diet. And just reducing it 5% is low carb, lower than the standard diet. But we're still talking a couple hundred grams of carbohydrate versus testing someone who's eating 50, right? There's a, in my hunch, right? My hypothesis is that there's a big difference on our physiology consuming 200 grams carbohydrate versus 50 or 20. And I don't know that we know what that threshold is. A lot of it depends on your activity and your glycogen demands and so on and so forth. But we don't have a real definition in the literature. So if someone says the research shows that low carb is ineffective, well, low carb what? What did they do? Did they lower it until, for example, we see ketones? Because that's one thing you could test. And it could be that we just lower carbohydrate gram by gram until there's ketone production.
Mm.
That is something you could test. And that way you're basing it off of their glucose demands or glycogen demands, off of their activity. And it's not a set number. You know, you could do that. For example, this is just I'm just throwing it out there as a possible study if anyone wants to do this or help me do this.
And it's interesting as well, because it will show that just how big the range is.
Mm-hmm.
You have to come up with some kind of number, some kind of generalized mm-hmm. number. You know, this whole 20 grams thing is a thing, isn't it? Because you kind of have to give some kind of number. But the reality is that it's completely different mm-hmm. for each individual. Like you say, depending on so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. For somebody to be producing ketones, it might mean they have to go down to total 5. For somebody else, they might be able to do it at 50. Mm-hmm. It really does depend, doesn't it?
And there's athletes who are consuming 100 grams or more, but these are extreme athletes.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that as well, how we define exercise for ourselves versus, say, an Olympian, right? Sometimes we think that we're doing some really intense exercise, but in reality, it isn't so intense. You know, I go to the gym and I'll see multiple people, and I've done it myself. We're sitting on the machine, like trying to get our music going. And I'm like, I am pretty sure we're just sitting. This is not exercise. So that's just another factor that affects so many things in relation to what we're eating. And that just complicates the story more. But we just need more information. And being able to reproduce, if we speak about it from that perspective, is such a fundamental piece of who we are. Whether you want to have a child or not is a separate piece, but just knowing that we have that piece of our health intact is so important that you would think we'd already know that. But the more I research in general, the more I see we just don't know very much. We think we do. We think we have these definitive answers. We'll say the science is settled on all sorts of things when really there's so much we don't know. You know, as I've said, there's just a really big gap in how what we eat affects our ability to conceive, fecundability, as that's called, and then also just ovulatory regularity. And I'm not even getting into egg quality, which is also a whole separate factor, because you can be ovulating regularly and not conceiving. And that can be related to the quality of the ovum. It could be male factor. It could be a lot of things. And so that's a whole separate issue. Whereas I'm just looking at, can we at least see regular ovulation, right? Which I consider, let's go to baseline and then let's optimize from there if we need to. I hope this happens in the next couple of years. We might be seeing more research coming out. I will be publishing my research study as part of my education program. I'm required to. And hopefully I'll have a lot of responses that say, look, these are some averages. Here's some statistics around at least the data that I gathered. Hopefully other students are interested in continuing it. That's one thing we do is, you know, we put together this research proposal that we then publish and say, if anyone wants to replicate this or take this further, here's everything I did. The work's done mm-hmm. for you. Add a little bit and continue on. Because ultimately, we're after that information. We're after an answer. And we all just have to keep building upon what we know and continuing from there.
That's the thing, isn't it? If we want any of these protocols to become official, if you want low carb to be part of the official advice that you're given when you go to a medical practitioner, you have to work backwards on that timeline. And for that to happen, you've got to have these studies like the ones you're proposing. And for that to happen, you've got to have people participating in the kind of research you're doing at the moment. So that's why it's so important, isn't it? It's so important for people like you to be doing the research, but it's really also very important for the people out there to participate and to help you achieve what is ultimately going to come back and help them.
Yes. And one thing I'm writing about in my thesis is about potentially describing some of these effects as glucose toxicity or carbohydrate overload, or looking at these as a problem that can be fixed, because in general, medical professionals want to fix a problem. So, for example, if we find that a case of ovulatory irregularity is due to excessive levels of insulin from glucose overload, then the treatment for addressing glucose overload would be a carbohydrate controlled diet appropriate for that individual, right? Mm-hmm. So then we can have a treatment plan, and there would be a protocol, and what that would be is going to be dependent upon what we find that works. But from that perspective, it's not just low carb. We're not just restricting. We're not just changing something kind of willy-nilly. We're addressing a specific identifiable problem in the lab results that can be addressed by direct manipulation of dietary intake. And that's a nutritional therapy. We look at things like the DASH diet is a nutritional therapy. I don't particularly love it, but that's how it was established. They said, okay, we have this lab result that we recognize as out of bounds, and by changing to this dietary protocol, it addresses that endpoint somewhat. Mm-hmm. So, but that's an example of how that came to be. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to have something along those lines, whatever the answer ends up being. I've seen, again, personally great results with a carbohydrate-controlled diet appropriate for my lifestyle, but we'll see if that's the case across the board and if that is appropriate for everyone. It's hard to say what is that range. I personally think the westernized diet of 45 to 65% carbohydrate is likely not appropriate for most humans. It doesn't seem to be evolutionarily appropriate. It doesn't seem to be historically what we would have eaten. Most people were far more active historically. So hopefully that will be established. And again, you know, the more help I have, the more responses I have to these surveys, the more of a case I can build that this needs to be tested. Mm-hmm. And if I can get into a PhD program and say, look how many results I had here, we need to test this, you know, maybe they were lying. We need to test it for real. I need to control this and see what happens. And that would be, you know, a dream come true for me. To say, after all of this, to say, wow, we found an intervention that works. Here's a protocol. We can publish this, distribute it to physicians, and that could be a first-line therapy, is a change in diet appropriate to address a symptom. That would just be phenomenal.
It would. I wish you all the luck in the world with it. I'm sure you will do well, and hopefully there will be some people out there listening who can either participate themselves or know of groups of people, or like you were saying before, maybe fertility clinics or some medical practitioners of any kind that's appropriate for this, who would like to participate and help out. Because as we were saying, the more participants, the better. This is how we will affect change.
Right. It becomes a higher powered study, as we would say.
Yeah.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Brian Tracy. Your life only gets better when you get better. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.